goes down.
Though we barely heard about it, in January, Pakistan suffered the world's fourth largest power blackout. 140 million people went dark, including the capital, Islamabad, and the country's largest city, Karachi. It was a terrorist attack, and that's the very thing that has worried top regulators and power companies in America and in every Western country. Could a big country like the U.S., Britain, or Canada go dark? And if so, for how long? And what can we do to prepare? These are all questions that we're going to talk over with our guest. He's one of the bright young men in American power these days. Darren Hamill is the chief strategy officer and co-founder of Princeton Power Systems, and that's a company that specializes in bringing renewable energy online. Darren, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi. Thank you, Alex. Thanks for having me.
Well, before we get to the solutions, and I know you have some, let's outline the depth of the risks we do face with these giant interlocking electric grids. What happened in Pakistan?
Sure. So in Pakistan, the attackers targeted a substation or multiple substations that kind of act as a central node on the grid. So taking out one of those substations can affect or will affect everybody downstream, which can be hundreds of thousands of people, depending on the size of the substation. That attack in particular was interesting because there was obviously intent to target that substation. We're more used to dealing in the U.S. with weather disasters that can have the same effect, but obviously come from a different intent.
But we did have one attack in Southern California on a substation that may have been terrorist. At least it was well planned and nobody's been caught yet. Can you tell us about that one?
Yeah, so sure. That one was sort of similar. It appeared as if the groups that were perpetrating that were kind of exploring what the effects would be. So it's maybe even more scary in that the effects were not as big as in Pakistan, but obviously if that were to be replicated or scaled up, everybody that's connected to the grid is connected to substations at some point. And as they get more and more central, you can kind of target a single substation that could affect a very wide area. And that's the worry in Southern California, in Silicon Valley. Some studies have shown that, a handful of substations could affect the vast majority of high-tech companies, not to mention residents and all the other buildings.
Oh, my gosh, not Facebook, not Twitter, please. The former the former chairman of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC, John Wellinghoff, has been practically yelling about how poorly the electricity system is defended against terrorism now. Would you agree?
Yeah, absolutely. And when we think about terrorism, to me, it also, again, comes back to the weather events, because they ultimately have the same effect. And some of the things that you would do to harden the grid are really the same. Chairman Wellinghoff was a really great advocate. He's obviously no longer the chairman at FERC, but I think it also goes to show the difficulty with changing the way that we think about the grid. For all the advocacy that he did, not a whole lot has really changed in the past couple years. So it's going to take a while to build that momentum, get that message out, and really start to see some changes.
Well, we have the specter of cyber attacks. We had Stuxnet in Iran that was designed by somebody to interfere with their nuclear systems. And all of our dams are operated remotely by computer. Our electrical systems are operated by computer. According to the Wall Street Journal, power companies reported 13 cyber attacks in just the last 3 years. I wonder how such an attack could work. Have you looked into that at all?
One of the areas that we've looked into are nuclear power plants, obviously some of the largest single plants and with dangerous fuel and other things associated. And there's a stat that I heard was that at some point every single nuke plant in the U.S. has been infiltrated successfully somewhat by cyber attack. It's not clear exactly what the perpetrators intend to do with the access that they get, but you could imagine, the science fiction sort of idea of changing around a certain valve, messing with a certain temperature setting, and kind of getting the whole system to run into overload. Now, if you talk to nuclear engineers, that's really it's not as easy as it sounds. And there are obviously a lot of smart people thinking about that and trying to prevent it. But on the other hand, everything's getting more and more connected, and that's what the bad guys do, is look for those pieces that they can exploit. And it's really not always obvious what they're going to go for. So step one is to get access, and then step two is, you know, who knows exactly what they're going to do with that. And unfortunately, they have been successful with getting access.
And we have now terrorist groups like ISIS, which are showing they're pretty smart in using electronic media. And there's the report of North Korea hacking Sony, possibly. We're not sure about that one, but it can happen in the real world.
Absolutely. And especially you get these very well-funded groups. And it's just a matter of what they want to put the resources into. And obviously Sony, you know, that's a big deal. But can you imagine a section of the power grid? You know, there's hospitals and much more kind of critical infrastructure that could be damaged.
And then we have something that is a small risk in that it may never happen, but a huge impact if it ever did. And that would be an EMP, an electromagnetic pulse, whether it comes from a nuke weapon blasted off in the atmosphere or from a solar storm. If we had a so-called Carrington event, the whole grid could go down possibly for years, some have said. Do you think that is a real concern or not?
You know, the idea with the grid that it is sort of centrally designed where you can take out a single point and that can have kind of a ripple effect across the entire grid is the way it was designed. So unfortunately, targeting some specific areas, you could have really massive effects. My personal opinion is that there are much easier ways to get those effects than through an EMP or a kind of a somewhat more complex mechanism. So we don't worry too much about that particular kind of attack, but the idea that you could attack one central location and have a pretty massive effect, whether it's by an EMP or just a physical assault on a substation like in Pakistan, that's probably a lot easier to do and unfortunately can have the same consequences.
Well, as you say, the best known terrorists are the trees, the weather, and human error. We had that big northeast blackout of the United States and Canada in 2003. That darkened 55 million people. What caused that one? Do you know?
In 2003, I think that one was actually more a matter of how the grid was sort of being balanced and regulated. And it was a cascading failure that started at a substation again with a relay switch, I believe. And that was more a case of where the way the system was designed, one kind of man-made error was able to cascade through a really long chain of events. And that's obviously a problem. You know, there's going to be human error no matter what we do, but there needs to be protections to isolate it. And that's kind of how the grid is designed. It's supposed to isolate itself. So that one, the kind of enormity of it was more a matter of almost kind of poor design and human error. But the idea that those relay stations can trip offline for any number of reasons, you know, that we have to expect that to continue to happen and just do a better job of preventing it from cascading.
Now, the four largest blackouts in the world all happened in Southeast Asia. The two biggest were in India and then Bangladesh, followed by the recent power loss in Pakistan. That India blackout of 2012 hit 620 million people. That's almost 10% of the world's humans. Are there particular reasons why that part of the world gets the big ones at this point?
Well, you know, unfortunately, that part of the world, even when it's not under blackout, the grid tends to be pretty unreliable. If you contrast like a system like where we're located, my company, we're in northern New Jersey, and we have what's called a networked grid. So there's a lot of power lines coming from multiple different generating stations and going into different neighborhoods, different distribution networks from multiple areas. So you're a little bit protected against one power plant going out. There's a lot of others that can kind of fill in for it. But if you look in the developing world, you know, it's been a challenge just to get any electricity to a lot of people, especially in kind of rural areas where it's pretty difficult to run power cables. So in some cases, you end up with one giant power cable coming from a central power plant, taking out that one cable that feeds hundreds of thousands, even millions of people. So it's a little bit of a matter of a less mature grid, and that's kind of fundamentally the case because you want to first just get access to electricity. So you want to invest almost the minimum that you can to make sure people are able to get electricity, and then over the years invest more in the hardening of that infrastructure. So it's just not quite as mature in most developing countries. And even in some places in the U.S. and other developed countries, different regions of the electrical grid are more susceptible to those kinds of outages.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Darren Hamill of Princeton Power Systems. We were talking about big electric blackouts and what we could do about them. So, various politicians, Darren, have been talking about a new smart grid for America. Is that the answer, and will it ever come?
Well, that's a good question. You know, the smart grid has become a term that's almost been co-opted to mean a whole lot of different things. The general idea of upgrading the electric grid, kind of modernizing it, bringing connectivity and networking to the different substations, that all definitely needs to happen. And at a minimum, that'll make the grid much more efficient and make us use less fuel to provide all the electricity we need. Some people also think about smart meters at the home, kind of networked and connected meters to get people to maybe be more conscious about how much energy they use. Those are all good things. I think you don't necessarily need all this technology like smart meters in order to get consumers to take a little more control over their energy usage, but technology is going to, you know, it's going to proceed. It's going to make some changes. But also we think about the smart grid as being a more distributed grid. So instead of the idea that you'd have a giant coal plant in the middle of the U.S. and then electric power lines that go out to serve everybody, you end up with smaller distributed generation stations that are closer to where the load is. So first of all, that's more efficient. You don't have to transmit the electricity quite as far. But it also ends up being a little more resilient. To make that work, you do need to connect all of those generators up to the electric grid, and they have to communicate in a kind of a networked way. And so that's also another kind of way that you can define the smart grid. And I think both of those things are definitely going to continue to happen.
Now, you have another solution. It is the microgrid. Could you please define what a microgrid is and then maybe give us a couple of examples?
Yeah, sure. So if you think about a generating station that's closer to the load, even, say, a college campus, if you had a generator on a college campus, typically if you'd want to add maybe energy storage, ideally a renewable generation source, solar power, wind power, and then you tie those things together with all the local buildings, and you give that, quote, microgrid the ability to disconnect from the electric grid. So most of the time, you're still going to be connected up to the wider electric grid, but you have the ability to disconnect and generate all of your own power in one local area. So the term microgrid could be used to describe, again, say, a college campus. It could also be used to describe just a building like a Home Depot, a Walmart, or a hospital, as long as it has its own generating station and has the ability to disconnect from the grid. And so we tend to focus on microgrids that have a renewable component because that's, again, another way to make the grid much more efficient. So some of the projects that we've done will include Alcatraz Island is a pretty famous example where it actually used to have a connection to the electric grid, but it's pretty much disconnected all the time now and just generates its own power locally. So it consists of a large solar array, a battery bank, and then two diesel generators that are operated only when there's not enough solar power to power the island. And another couple examples, the U.S. military is doing a lot with microgrids. Down at Fort Bliss and Fort Carson are probably the best known examples. And these are systems that include solar generators, natural gas, diesel generators, large battery systems, large energy storage, and even the ability to charge electric vehicles, again, from a local grid that can disconnect from the utility, sort of whenever it wants to. But the idea is if there are terrorist events or other events that take down the bigger electric grid, these microgrids can continue operating.
And we have things like the big hurricanes, like Hurricane Sandy. If we'd had more microgrids then, we might have been better off.
Yeah, absolutely. That was a real eye-opener for people in our part of the world that we actually had generating stations. A lot of people have invested in solar panels in particular. But when the grid goes down, these things don't operate. And people were pretty unaware of that. So there's a movement to allow those solar panels to install the technology that allows those to operate when the rest of the electric grid is down. And so you can imagine even at the residential level, if you had a solar array, the grid goes down, but that solar array can still provide at least some kind of backup to your house. You know, at a minimum, you're able to charge your cell phones and keep some emergency lighting on. That became really important to a lot of people that that hadn't thought about it before. Sandy in particular, but also, you know, in Connecticut and other places, they had a couple storms even before Sandy.
That could be tricky to implement, though. I'd like to do that, but the local provider says, well, no, you either have to be grid-tied or you have to be off the grid, but we won't let you do both.
Yeah, it's a technology solution, and the solution exists, but there is an educational piece trying to get local inspectors comfortable with it. So what we've done is there is a standard. It's an underwriter laboratory UL standard that will allow you to operate in an on-grid mode. So most of the time you're selling your solar electricity back to the grid. But if the grid goes down for whatever reason, that system is allowed to separate from the grid and then create a small microgrid at your home or at your building. And that's essentially what our equipment does, is it provides that off-grid solution, and then it'll actually reconnect back to the electric grid when it comes back online. So this is a technical solution that has been blessed by the kind of national regulators. So there's still an educational component to get more local permitting authorities comfortable with it, but there's no reason they shouldn't sign off on it since it meets all these national safety standards.
So if I'm a homeowner who wants that, where do I find it?
Well, you can start by checking out our website at princetonpower.com. And there are other companies that do similar things. The idea is it's a UL1741 compliant power electronics inverter. That's really the key. And then designing the system around that, you can add, you know, different kinds of generating sources. But that's the key, is you need a power electronics system that's UL certified and is capable of on-grid and off-grid, or sometimes it's called island mode.
I've got to find it. Well, I just saw an article about four homes in Missouri with rooftop solar panels and a microgrid, and the project was built by students and then set up by the Missouri University of Science and Technology. And it got me wondering, when do we move from this sort of pioneer mode of microgrids to a larger scale implementation?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, the idea of operating off-grid, operating with solar, is obviously not a new one. It's been around for many, many decades, and people, really, really smart people, have been doing that kind of pioneering effort. But I think we really are at an inflection point, and again, Sandy was a big one for where we live in our area, where people have started investing a lot in solar, and there are a lot of deployments out there. But nobody realized that they didn't operate in this off-grid mode. So when that became apparent to people, people started asking the question, well, what would it take to do this? And at the same time, in parallel, the technology is there and the products are there now to do this pretty easily. So a whole key really is meeting these national code standards, because that makes everybody comfortable with much wider scale deployments. So we've done that, and I think the industry is there in terms of technology and products. And so now it's really about the education. If someone's going to invest in a local solar system, it's a pretty small marginal cost to make that off-grid, to make that a resilient solar system. So that's really the message that we're trying to get out there. And a lot of people are responding to it, but there is a lot of work to go to make it really a widespread thing.
Yeah, I don't know if you're familiar with the work of Joseph Tainter, but he looked at the rise and fall of empires with an eye to fragility and complexity, and he says, when large empires become too complex, they break down, but they break down into smaller, more self-sufficient islands, and I'm thinking like the medieval fortress cities that operated as nation-states. I'm almost wondering whether this new need for microgrids doesn't reflect an uncertainty about the future of big systems. What do you think about that?
Yeah, that's a really interesting idea. And, you know, kind of as a corollary to that, one reason that even utilities are investing in smaller distributed power plants is just that the speed and simplicity of getting those smaller plants sited, permitted, and built is just much, much easier than trying to build these kind of monolithic centralized power plants. So you end up with less complex, smaller generators kind of around the edges of the grid. And it's really kind of a natural, you know, market-based force that's making that happen, led by the technology getting much less expensive to put these power plants in a distributed place. But, yeah, that's a really good point. So, once you have those distributed power plants out there, the need for this really complex kind of command and control system goes away as long as those distributed assets can communicate with each other and even disconnect from the grid if something does go wrong.
Darren, beyond PrincetonPower.com, can you recommend places where people can go to find out more about making our electric grid more resilient?
Sure. So Idaho National Lab actually just put out a really interesting study. I forget the exact name of it, but if you go to the Idaho National Lab page, I'm sure you'll find it there. NREL, the National Renewable Energy Lab, has done a lot of work with distributed solar and the technologies out there. And also the Rocky Mountain Institute is a nonprofit group that we've worked with that's recently published a really good report on the economics of what they call defecting from the grid. So that's sort of the extreme case where it's less expensive to generate your own power than it is to connect to the grid. So people may actually migrate towards their own kind of distributed systems. But that's a really good paper, the Rocky Mountain Institute website. I'm sure you can find it on there.
We've been talking with an entrepreneur with Renewable Energy Systems. Darren Hamill is with Princeton Power. You can find links to everything we've been talking about in my weekly show blog, published every Wednesday at ecoshock.info. Thank you so much for joining us, Darren.
Thank you, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.